Since the focus of their thoughts was the woman who had raised them and the visible fact that she was fading away. Bill said,
"My Sarah's daughter was named Caroline for her grandmother, my wife."
"My name?"
Miss Caroline sounded pleased, though her voice was a little weaker.
"Yes, your name. My granddaughter Caroline married a cousin, Matthew Phillips Holliday."
"Why, those are my mother and father."
She smiled, which did drastic things to her scores of wrinkles.
"So, you are, really?"
To my amazement, Caroline Bellefleur laughed.
"Your great-grandfather. Yes, I am."
Portia made a sound as though she were choking on a stink bug. Miss Caroline disregarded her granddaughter entirely, and she didn't look over at Andy, which was lucky because he was turkey waddle red.
"Well, if this isn't funny," she said.
"I'm as wrinkled as an ironed linen, and you're as smooth as a fresh peach."
She was genuinely amused.
"Great granddaddy."
Then a thought seemed to occur to the dying lady.
"Was it you arranged for that timely windfall we got?"
"The money couldn't have been put to better use," Bill said gallantly. "The house looks beautiful. Who will live in it after you die?"
Portia gasped, and Andy looked a little taken aback. But I glanced at the nurse. She gave me a brief nod. Miss Caroline's time was very near, and the lady was fully aware of it.
"Well, I think Portia and Glenn will stay here,"
Miss Caroline said slowly. It was evident she was tiring fast.
"Hallie and Andy want to have their baby in their own home, and I don't blame them one bit. You're not saying you're interested in the house?"
"Oh, no, I have my own,"
Bill reassured her.
"And I was glad to give my own family the wherewithal to repair this place. I want my descendants to keep on living here through the years and have many happy times in this place."
"Thank you,"
Miss Caroline said, and now her voice was barely a whisper.
"Sookie and I must go," Bill said. "You rest easy now."
"I will,"
she said, and smiled, though her eyes were closing. I rose as quietly as I could and slipped out of the room ahead of Bill. I thought Portia and Andy might want to say a few things to Bill. Sure enough, they didn't want to disturb their grandmother, so they followed Bill out onto the gallery.
"Thought you were dating another vampire now,"
Andy asked me. He didn't sound as snarky as he usually did.
"I am," I said, "but Bill is still my friend."
Portia had briefly dated Bill, though not because she thought he was cute or anything. I was sure that added to her embarrassment as she stuck out her hand to Bill. Portia needed to brush up on her vampire etiquette. Though Bill looked a little taken aback, he accepted the handshake.
"Portia,"
he said.
"Andy, I hope you don't find this too awkward."
I was busting at the seams, proud of Bill. It was easy to see where Caroline Bellefleur had gotten her graciousness. Andy said,
"I wouldn't have taken the money if I'd known it came from you."
He'd evidently come straight from work because he was wearing all his gear, a badge and handcuffs clipped to his belt, a holstered gun. He looked pretty formidable, but he was no match for Bill, even as sick as Bill was.
"Andy, I know you're not a fan of the Fang, but you're part of my family, and I know you were raised to respect your elders."
Andy looked completely taken aback.
"That money was to make Caroline happy, and I think it did,"
Bill continued,
"so it served its purpose. I've gotten to see her and to tell her about our relationship, and she has the Bible. I won't burden you with my presence any longer. I would ask that you have the funeral at night so I can attend."
"Whoever heard of a funeral at night?" Andy said.
"Yes, we'll do that."
Portia didn't sound warm and welcoming, but she did sound absolutely resolved.
"The money made her last few years very happy. She loved restoring the house to its best state, and she loved giving us the wedding here. The Bible is the frosting on the cake. Thank you." Bill nodded to both of them, and without further ado, we left Belle Reve. Caroline Bellefleur, Bill's great-granddaughter, died in the early hours of the morning. Bill sat with the family during the funeral, which took place the next night to the profound amazement of the town. I sat at the back with Sam. It wasn't an occasion for tears. Without a doubt, Caroline Bellefleur had had a long life, a life not devoid of sorrow, but at least full of moments of compensatory happiness. She had very few remaining contemporaries, and those who were still alive were almost all too tottery to come to her funeral. The service seemed quite normal until we drove out to the cemetery, which didn't have night lighting, of course, and I saw that temporary lights had been set up around the perimeter of the grave in the Bellefleur plot. That was a strange sight. The minister had a hard time reading the service until a member of the congregation held his own flashlight to the page. The bright lights in the dark night were an unpleasant reminder of the recovery of Basim al-Saud's body. It was hard to think properly about Miss Caroline's life and legacy with all the conjecture rattling around in my head. And why hadn't anything already happened? I felt as though I were living, waiting for the other shoe to drop. I wasn't aware my hand had tightened on Sam's arm until he turned to look at me with some alarm. I forced my fingers to relax and bowed my head for the prayer. The family, I heard, was going to Belle Reve for a buffet meal after the service. I wondered if they'd gotten Bill his favorite blood. Bill looked awful. He was using a cane at the gravesite. Something had to be done about finding his sibling, since he wasn't taking action himself. If there was a chance his sibling's blood might cure him, the effort had to be made. I'd driven to the funeral with Sam, and since my house was so close, I told Sam I'd walk back from the gravesite. I'd stuck a little flashlight in my purse, and I reminded Sam I knew the cemetery like the back of my hand. So, when all the other attendees took off, including Bill, to go to Belle Reve for the buffet meal, I waited in the shadows until the cemetery employees started filling in the hole, and then I walked through the trees to Bill's house. I still had a key. Yes, I knew I was being a terrible busybody, and maybe I was doing the wrong thing, but Bill was wasting away, and I just couldn't sit by and let him do it. I unlocked the front door and went to Bill's office, which had been the Compton formal dining room. Bill had all his computer gear set up on a huge table, and he had a rolling chair he'd gotten at Office Depot. A smaller table served as a mailing station where Bill prepared copies of his vampire database to send to purchasers. He advertised heavily in vampire magazines, Fang, of course, and Dead Life, which appeared in so many languages. Bill's newest marketing effort involved hiring vampires who spoke many different languages to translate all the information so he could sell foreign language editions of his worldwide vampire listing service. As I remembered from a previous visit, there were a dozen CD copies of his database in cases by his mailing station. I double-checked to make sure I had one that was in English. Wouldn't do me much good to get one in Russian. Of course, Russian reminded me of Alexei, and thinking of Alexei reminded me all over of how worried, angry, and frightened I was about Eric's silence. I could feel my mouth pinching together in a really unpleasant expression as I thought about that silence. But I had to pay attention to my own little problem right now, and I scooted out of the house, relocked the door, and hoped Bill wouldn't pick up on my scent in the air. I went through the cemetery as quickly as if it had been daytime. When I was in my own kitchen, I looked around for a good hiding place. I finally fixed on the linen closet in the hall bathroom as a good spot, and I put the CD under the stack of clean towels. I didn't think even Claude could use 5 towels before I got up the next day. I checked my answering machine. I checked my cell phone, which I hadn't taken to the service. No messages. I undressed slowly, trying to imagine what could have happened to Eric. I decided I wouldn't call him, no matter what. He knew where I was and how to reach me. I hung my black dress in the closet, put my black heels on the shoe rack, and then pulled on my Tweety Bird nightshirt, an old favorite. Then I went to bed, mad as a wet hen. And scared. Chapter 10.
Claude hadn't come home the night before. His car wasn't by the back door. I was glad someone had gotten lucky. Then I told myself not to be so pitiful.
"You're doing okay," I said, looking in the mirror so I'd believe it. "Look at you. Great tan, suck."
I had to be in for the lunch shift, so I got dressed right after I'd eaten breakfast. I retrieved the purloined CD from under the towels. I'd either pay Bill for it or return it, I told myself virtuously. I hadn't really stolen it if I planned to pay for it. Someday. I looked at the clear plastic case in my hands. I wondered how much the FBI would pay for it. Despite all Bill's attempts to make sure only vampires bought the CD, it would be truly amazing if no one else had it. So I opened it and popped it into my computer. After a preliminary whir, the screen popped up. "The Vampire Directory," it said in gothic lettering, red on a black screen. Stereotype, anyone?
"Enter your code number," prompted the screen.
Uh-oh. Then I remembered there'd been a little post-it on top of the case, and I dug it out of the wastebasket. Yep, this was surely a code. Bill would never have attached the code to the box if he hadn't believed his house was secure, and I felt a pang of guilt. I didn't know what procedure he'd established, but I assumed he put the code in a directory when he mailed out the disk to a happy customer. Or maybe he'd put a destruct code on the paper for fools like me, and the whole thing would blow up in my face. I was glad no one else was in the house after I typed in the code and hit enter, because I dropped to my knees under the desk. Nothing happened, except some more whirring, and I figured I was safe. I scrambled back into my chair. The screen was showing me my options. I could search by country of residence, country of origin, name, or last sighting. I clicked on residence, and I was prompted, which country? I could pick from a list. After I clicked on USA, I got another prompt, what state? And another list. I clicked on Louisiana, and then on Compton. There he was, in a modern picture taken at his house. I recognized the paint color. Bill was smiling stiffly, and he didn't look like a party animal, that's for sure. I wondered how he'd fare with a dating service. I began to read his biography, and sure enough, there at the bottom I read, "Sired by Lorena Ball of Louisiana, 1870. But there was no listing for brothers or sisters. Okay, it wasn't going to be that easy. I clicked on the bold-faced name of Bill's sire, the late, unlamented Lorena. I was curious as to what her entry would say, since Lorena had met the ultimate death, at least until they learned how to resuscitate ashes. "Lorena Ball," her entry read, with only a drawing. It was a pretty good likeness, I thought, cocking my head as I looked it over. "Turned in 1788 in New Orleans, lived all across the South, but returned to Louisiana after the Civil War, had met the son, murder by person or persons unknown." Huh. Bill knew perfectly well who'd killed Lorena, and I could only be glad he hadn't put my name in the directory. I wondered what would have happened to me if he had. See, you think you have enough to worry about, but then you think of a possibility you'd never imagined, and you realize you have even more problems. Okay, here we go. Sired Bill Compton, 1870, and Judith Vardaman, 1902. Judith. So this was Bill's sister. After some more clicking and reading, I discovered that Judith Vardaman was still alive, or at least she had been when Bill had been compiling his database. She lived in Little Rock. I further discovered I could send her an email. Naturally, she wasn't obliged to answer it. I stared down at my hands, and I thought hard. I thought about how awful Bill looked. I thought about his pride and the fact that he hadn't yet contacted this Judith, though he suspected her blood would cure him. Bill wasn't a fool, so there was some good reason he hadn't called this other child of Lorena. I just didn't know that reason. But if Bill had decided she shouldn't be contacted, he knew what he was doing, right? Oh, to hell with it. I typed in her email address and moved the cursor down to the topic. Typed, "Bill's ill." Thought that looked almost funny. Almost changed it, but didn't. Moved the cursor down to the body of the email, clicked again, hesitated. Then I typed, "I'm Bill Compton's neighbor.
I don't know how long it's been since you heard from him, but he lives at his old home place in Bonneton, Louisiana now. Bill's got silver poisoning. He can't heal without your blood. He doesn't know I'm sending this. We used to date, and we're still friends. I want him to get better. I signed it, because anonymous is not my style. I clenched my teeth really hard together. I clicked on send. As much as I wanted to keep the CD and browse through it, my little code of honor told me I had to return it without enjoying it, because I hadn't paid. So I got Bill's key and put the disc back in its plastic case and started across the cemetery. I slowed as I drew near to the Bellefleur plot. The flowers were still piled on Miss Caroline's grave. Andy was standing there, staring at a cross made out of red carnations. I thought it was pretty awful, but this was definitely an occasion for the thought to count more than the deed. I didn't think Andy was registering what was right in front of him anyway. I felt as though thief were burned onto my forehead. I knew Andy wouldn't care if I backed up a truck to Bill's house and loaded up all the furniture and drove off with it. It was my own sense of guilt that was plaguing me.
Sookie,
Andy said. I hadn't realized he'd noticed me. Andy, I said cautiously. I wasn't sure where this conversation would go, and I had to leave for work soon.
You still have relatives in town, or have they left?
They're leaving after lunch, he said. Hallie had to work on some class preparations this morning, and Glenn had to run into his office to catch up on paperwork. This has been the hardest on Portia.
I guess she'll be glad when things get back to normal. That seemed safe enough.
Yeah, she's got a law practice to run.
Did the lady who was taking care of Miss Caroline have another job to go to?
Reliable caregivers were as scarce as hen's teeth and far more valuable.
Doreen? Yeah, she moved right across the garden to Mr. DeWitt's.
After an uncomfortable pause, he said,
She kind of got on to me that night, after you all left. I know I wasn't polite to Bill.
It's been a hard time for you all.
It makes me mad that we were getting charity.
You weren't, Andy. Bill is your family. I know it must feel weird, and I know you don't think much of vampires in general, but he's your great-great-great-grandfather, and he wanted to help out his people. It wouldn't make you feel funny if he'd left you money and he was out here with Miss Caroline under the ground, would it? It's just that Bill's still walking around.
Andy shook his head, as if flies were buzzing around it. His hair was thinning, I noticed.
You know what my grandmother's last request was?
I couldn't imagine.
No, I said.
She left her chocolate cake recipe to the town,
he said, and he smiled.
A damn recipe. And you know what? They were as excited at the newspaper when I took that recipe in as if it were Christmas and I'd brought them a map to Jimmy Hoffa's body.
It's gonna be in the paper?
I sounded as thrilled as I felt. I bet there would be at least 100 chocolate cakes in the oven the day the paper came out.
See, you're all excited too,
Andy said, sounding 5 years younger.
Andy, that's big news, I assured him.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go return something.
And I hurried through the rest of the cemetery to Bill's house. I put the CD, complete with its little sticky note, on top of the pile from which I'd taken it, and I skedaddled. I second-guessed myself, and third, fourth, and fifth-guessed, too. At Merlot's, I worked in a kind of haze, concentrating fiercely on getting lunch orders right, being quick, and responding instantly to any request. My other sense told me that despite my efficiency, people weren't glad to see me coming, and I really couldn't blame them. Tips were low. People were ready to forgive inefficiency as long as you smiled while you were sloppy. They didn't like the unsmiling, quick-handed me. I could tell, simply because he thought it so often, that Sam was assuming I'd had a fight with Eric. Holly thought I was having my period. And Antoine was an informant. Our cook had been lost in his own broody mood. I realized how resistant he normally was to my telepathy only when he forgot to be. I was waiting on an order to be up at the hatch, and I was looking at Antoine while he flipped a burger, and I heard directly from him,
Not getting off work to meet that asshole again. He can just stuff it up his butt. I'm not telling him nothing else.
Then Antoine, who I'd come to respect and admire, flipped the burger onto its waiting bun, and turned to the hatch with a plate in his hand. He met my eyes squarely.
Oh, shit,
he thought.
Let me talk to you before you do anything,
he said, and I knew for sure that he was a traitor. No, I said, and turned away, going right to Sam, who was behind the bar washing glasses.
Antoine is some kind of agent for the government,
I said, very quietly. Sam didn't ask me how I knew, and he didn't question my statement. His mouth pressed into a hard line.
We'll talk to him later, he said. Thanks, Sook.
I regretted now that I hadn't told Sam about the ware buried on my land. I was always sorry when I didn't tell Sam something, it seemed. I got the plate and took it to the right table without meeting Antoine's eyes. Some days, I hated my ability more than others. Today was one of those days. I'd been much happier, though in retrospect it had been a foolish happiness, when I'd assumed Antoine was a new friend. I wondered if any of the stories he told about going through Katrina and the Superdome had been true, or if those had been lies too. I'd felt such sympathy for him, and I'd never had a hint until now that his persona was false. How could that be? First, I don't monitor every single thought of every person. I block a lot of it out, in general, and I try especially hard to stay out of the heads of my co-workers. Second, people don't always think about critical stuff in explicit terms. A guy might not think, I believe I'll get the pistol from under the seat of my truck and shoot Jerry in the head for screwing my wife. I was much more likely to get an impression of sullen anger with overtones of violence, or even a projection of how it might feel to shoot Jerry. But the shooting of Jerry might not have reached the specific planning stage at the moment the shooter was in the bar when I was privy to his thoughts. And mostly people didn't act on their violent impulses, something I didn't learn until after some very painful incidents as I grew up. If I spent my life trying to figure out the background of every single thought I heard, I wouldn't have my own life. At least I had something to think about besides wondering what the hell was happening with Eric and the Longtooth Pack. At the end of my shift, I found myself in Sam's office with Sam and Antoine. Sam shut the door behind me. He was furious. I didn't blame him. Antoine was mad at himself, mad at me, and defensive with Sam. The atmosphere in the room was choking with anger and frustration and fear.
Listen, man,
Antoine said. He was standing facing Sam. He made Sam look small.
Just listen, okay? After Katrina, I didn't have no place to live and nothing to do. I was trying to find work and keep myself going. I couldn't even get a damn FEMA trailer. Things were going bad. So I borrowed a car to get to Texas to some relatives. I was gonna dump it where the cops could find it, get it back to the owner. I know it was stupid. I know I shouldn't have done it, but I was desperate, and I did something dumb.
Yet you're not in jail, Sam observed. His words were like a whip that barely flicked Antoine, drew a little bit of blood. Antoine breathed out heavily.
No, I'm not. And I'll tell you why. My uncle is a werewolf in one of the New Orleans packs, so I knew something about him. An FBI agent named Sarah Weiss came to talk to me in jail. She was okay. But after she spoke with me once, she brought this guy Letesta, Tom Letesta. He said he was based in Rhodes, and I couldn't figure out what he was doing in New Orleans. But he told me that he knew all about my uncle, and he figured that you all were coming out sooner or later, since the vamps did. He knew what you were, that there were other things besides wolves. He knew there'd be a lot of people didn't like hearing the people who were part animal lived in with the rest of us. He described Sookie to me. He said she was something strange, too, and he didn't know what. He sent me here to watch, to see what happened.
Sam and I exchanged glances. I don't know what Sam had anticipated, but this was way more serious than I'd imagined. I figured back. Tom Letesta has known all along, I said. When did he start thinking there was something wrong with me? Had it been before he saw the footage from the hotel explosion in Rhodes, which he'd used as the reason for approaching me a few months ago?
Half the time he's sure you're a fraud. Half the time he thinks you're the real deal.
I turned to my boss. Sam, He came to my house the other day, Letesta. He told me that someone close to me, one of the great relatives, I didn't want to get more specific in front of Antoine, had fixed it so he had to back off.
That explains why I was so mad, Antoine said, and his face hardened. That explains a lot.
What did he tell you to do? Sam asked.
Letesta said the car theft thing was forgotten as long as I kept an eye on Sam and any other people who weren't all the way human who came into the bar. He said he couldn't touch Sookie now, and he was mighty pissed.
Sam looked at me, a question on his face. He's sincere, I said.
Thank you, Sookie, Antoine said.
He looked abjectly miserable. Okay, Sam said after looking at Antoine for a few more seconds.
You still have a job?
No conditions?
Antoine was looking at Sam unbelievingly.
He expects me to keep watching you.
Not a condition, but a warning. If you tell him one thing more besides the fact that I'm here and running this business, you're out of here. And if I can think of something else to do to you, I will.
Antoine seemed weak with relief.
I'll do my best for you, Sam,
he said.
Tell the truth, I'm glad it all came out. It's been sitting heavy on my conscience.
There'll be a backlash, I said, when Sam and I were alone.
I know. Letesta will come down on him hard, and Antoine will be tempted to make something up to tell him.
I think Antoine is a good guy. I hope I'm not wrong. I'd been wrong about people before, in major ways.
Yeah, I hope he lives up to our expectations.
Sam smiled at me suddenly. He had a great smile, and I couldn't help but smile back.
It's good to have faith in people sometimes, give them another chance, and we'll both keep our eyes on them.
I nodded. Okay, well, I better get home. I wanted to check my cell phone for messages and my landline, too, and my computer. I was dying for someone to reach out and touch me.
Is something the matter?
Sam asked. He reached out to give me a tentative pat on the shoulder.
Anything I can do?
You're the greatest, I said, but I'm just trying to get through a bad situation.
Eric's out of touch,
he said, proving that Sam is one shrewd guesser. Yeah, I admitted, and he's got relatives in town. I don't know what the hell's going on. The word relatives jogged my brain. How are things going in your family, Sam?
The divorce is no fault, and it's going through, he said. My mom is pretty miserable, but she'll be better as time goes on, I hope. Some of the people in Ride are giving her the cold shoulder. She let Mindy and Craig watch her change.
What form did she pick? I'd rather be a shapeshifter than a were-animal, so I'd have a choice.
Scotty, I think. My sister took it real well. Mindy's always been more flexible than Craig.
I thought women were almost always more flexible than men, but I didn't think I needed to say that out loud. Generalizations like that can come back to bite you in the ass. Deidre's family settled down?
Looks like the wedding's back on, as of 2 nights ago, Sam said. Her mom and dad finally got that the contamination couldn't spread to Deidre and Craig and their kids, if they have any.
So you think the wedding will take place?
Yeah, I do. You still going to write with me?
I started to say, you still want me to? But that would have been unduly coy, since he just asked me. When the date is set, you'll have to ask my boss if I can get off work, I told him. Sam, it may be tacky of me to persist in asking, but why aren't you taking Janilyn? I wasn't imagining the discomfort that emanated from Sam.
She's... I can just tell that she and my mom wouldn't get along. If I do introduce her to my family, I think I better wait until the tension of the wedding isn't part of the picture. My mom's still jangled from the shooting and the divorce, and Janilyn is not a calm person.
In my opinion, if you were dating someone you were clearly embarrassed to introduce to your family, you were probably dating the wrong person. But Sam hadn't asked me for my opinion. No, she certainly isn't a calm individual, I said. And now that she's got those new responsibilities, she's got to be pretty focused on the pack, I guess.
What? What new responsibilities?
Uh-oh. I'm sure she'll tell you all about it, I said. I guess you haven't seen her in a couple of days, huh?
Nope. So we're both down in the dumps,
he said. I was willing to concede I'd been pretty grim, and I smiled at him.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, I said. With Eric's maker being in town and him being scarier than Freddy Krueger, I'm pretty much on my own, I guess.
If we don't hear from our significant others, let's go out tomorrow night. We can hit Crawdad Diner again, Sam said, or I can grill us some steaks.
Sounds good, I told him, and I appreciated his offer. I'd been feeling kind of cast adrift.
Jason was apparently busy with Michelle, and after all, he'd stayed the other night when I'd half expected him to scoot out of the house. Eric was busy, apparently. Claude was almost never at the house and awake when I was awake. Tara was busy being pregnant, and Amelia had time to send me only the occasional email. Though I didn't mind being by myself from time to time, in fact, I enjoyed it. I'd had a little too much of it lately, and being alone is a lot more fun if it's optional.
Relieved that the conversation with Antoine was over, and wondering what trouble Tom Letesta might cause in the future, I grabbed my purse from the drawer in Sam's desk and headed for home. It was a beautiful late afternoon when I pulled up in back of the house. I thought of working out to an exercise DVD before I fixed supper. Claude's car was gone. I hadn't noticed Jason's truck, so I was surprised to see him sitting on my back steps.
Hey, brother,
I called as I got out of the car.
Listen, let me ask you.
And then, getting his mental signature, I realized the man sitting on the steps wasn't Jason. I froze. All I could do was stare at my half-fey great-uncle Dermot and wonder if he had come to kill me. Chapter 11. He could have slain me about 60 times in the seconds I stood there. Despite the fact that he didn't, I still didn't want to take my eyes off him.
Don't be afraid,
Dermot said, rising with grace that Jason could never have matched. He moved like his joints were machine-made and well-oiled. I said through numb lips,
Can't help it. I want to explain, he said as he drew nearer.
Explain?
I wanted to get closer to both of you, he said.
He was well into my personal space by then. His eyes were blue like Jason's, candid like Jason's, and really, seriously crazy, not like Jason's.
I was confused.
About what?
I wanted to keep the conversation going. I surely did, because I didn't know what would happen when it came to a halt.
About where my loyalties lay,
he said, bowing his head as gracefully as a swan.
Sure, tell me about that.
Oh, if only I had my squirt gun loaded with lemon juice in my purse. But I'd promised Eric I'd put it on my nightstand when Claude had come to live with me, so that was where it lay. And the iron trowel was where it was supposed to be, in the tool shed.
I will,
he said, standing close enough that I could smell him. He smelled great. Fairies always do.
I know you met my father, Niall.
I nodded, a very small movement.
Yes,
I said to make sure.
Did you love him?
Yes, I said without hesitation. I did. I do.
He's easy to love. He's charming,
Dermot said.
My mother, Einan, was beautiful too. Not a fairy kind of beautiful like Niall, but she was human beautiful.
That's what Niall told me,
I said. I was picking my way through a conversational minefield.
Did he tell you the water fairies murdered my twin?
Did Niall tell me your brother was murdered? No, but I heard.
I saw parts of Fintan's body. Neve and Lachlan had torn him limb from limb.
They helped drown my parents, too,
I said, holding my breath. What would he say?
He struggled to speak, his face desperate. But I wasn't there. Niall!
It was terrible to watch Dermot struggle to speak.
I shouldn't have had any mercy for him, since Niall had told me about Dermot's part in my parents' deaths, but I really couldn't endure his pain.
So, how come you ended up siding with Brendan's forces in the war?
He told me my father had killed my brother,
Dermot said bleakly.
And I believed him. I mistrusted my love for Niall. When I remembered my mother's misery after Niall stopped coming to visit her, I thought Brendan must be right and we weren't meant to mingle with humans. It never seems to turn out well for them, and I hated what I was, half-human. I was never at home anywhere.
So, are you feeling better now? About being a little bit human?
I've come to terms with it. I know my former actions were wrong, and I'm grieved that my father won't let me into Faerie.
The big blue eyes looked sad. I was too busy trying not to shake to get the full impact.
In a breath, out a breath. Calm, calm. So now you're thinking Jason and I are okay? You don't want to hurt us anymore?
He put his arms around me. This was hug sookie season, and no one had told me ahead of time. Fairies were very touchy-feely, and personal space didn't mean anything to them. I would have liked to tell my great-uncle to back off, but I didn't dare. I didn't need to read Dermot's mind to understand that almost anything could set him off, so delicate was his mental balance. I had to stiffen all my resolution to maintain my even breathing so I wouldn't shiver and shake. His nearness and the tension of being in his presence, the huge strength that hummed through his arms, took me back to a dark, ruined shack and two psycho fairies who really had deserved their deaths. My shoulders jerked, and I saw a flash of panic in Dermot's eyes.
Calm, be calm.
I smiled at him. I have a pretty smile, people tell me, though I know it's a little too bright, a little nuts. However, that suited the conversation perfectly.
The last time you saw Jason,
I said, and then I couldn't think how to finish.
I attacked his companion, the beast who'd hurt Jason's wife.
I swallowed hard and smiled some more.
Probably would have been better if you'd explained to Jason why you were going after Mel, and it wasn't Mel who killed her, you know.
No, it was my own kind that finished her off, but she would have died anyway. He wasn't taking her to get help, you know.
Wasn't much I could say, because his account of what had happened to Crystal was accurate. I noticed I hadn't gotten a coherent response from Dermot on why he'd left Jason in ignorance of Mel's crime.
But you didn't explain to Jason,
I said, breathing in and out in a very soothing way. I hoped. It seemed to me that the longer I touched Dermot, the calmer we both got, and Dermot was markedly more coherent.
I was very conflicted,
he said seriously, unexpectedly borrowing from modern jargon. Maybe that was as good an answer as I was going to get. I decided to take another tack.
Did you want to see Claude?
I said hopefully. He's living with me now, just temporarily. He should be back later tonight.
I'm not the only one, you know,
Dermot told me. I looked up and met his mad eyes. I understood that my great-uncle was trying to tell me something. I wished to God I could make him rational, just for 5 minutes. I stepped back from him and tried to figure out what he needed.
You're not the only fairy left out in the human world. I know Claude's here. Someone else is, too?
I would have enjoyed my telepathy for a couple of minutes.
Yes, yes.
His eyes were pleading with me to understand. I'd risk a direct question.
Who else is on this side of Faerie?
You don't want to meet him,
Dermot assured me. You have to be careful. He can't decide right now. He's ambivalent.
Right.
Whoever he wasn't the only one who had mixed feelings. I wished I knew the right nutcracker that would open up Dermot's head.
Sometimes he's in your woods.
Dermot put his hands on my shoulders and squeezed gently. It was like he was trying to transmit things he couldn't say directly into my flesh. I heard about that, I said sourly.
Don't trust other fairies, Dermot told me. I shouldn't have.
I felt like a light bulb had popped on above my head.
Dermot, have you had magic put on you? Like a spell?
The relief in his eyes was almost palpable. He nodded frantically.
Unless they're at war, fairies don't like to kill other fairies, except for Niamh and Lachlan. They liked to kill everything, but I'm not dead, so there's hope.
Fairies might be reluctant to kill their own kind, but they didn't mind making them insane, apparently.
Is there anything I can do to reverse this spell? Can Claude help?
Claude has little magic, I think, Dermot said. He's been living like a human too long. My dearest niece, I love you. How is your brother?
We were back in Nutty Land.
God bless poor Dermot.
I hugged him, following an impulse.
My brother is happy, Uncle Dermot. He's dating a woman who suits him, and she won't take any shit off him either. Her name is Michelle, like my mom's, but with one L instead of two.
Dermot smiled down at me. Hard to say how much of this he was absorbing.
Dead things love you, Dermot told me, and I made myself keep smiling.
Eric the vampire? He says he does.
Other dead things, too. They're pulling on you.
That was a not-so-welcome revelation. Dermot was right. I'd been feeling Eric through our bond as usual, but there were two other gray presences with me every moment after dark. Alexei and Appius Livius. It was a drain on me, and I hadn't realized it until this moment.
Tonight, Dermot said, you'll receive visitors.
So now he was a prophet?
Good ones?
He shrugged.
That's a matter of taste and expedience.
Hey, Uncle Dermot, do you walk around this land very often?
Too scared of the other one. But I try to watch you a little.
I was figuring out if that was a good thing or a bad thing when he vanished. Poof! I saw a kind of blur, and then nothing. His hands were on my shoulders, and then they weren't. I assumed the tension of conversing with another person had gotten to Dermot. Boy, that had been really, really weird. I glanced around me, thinking I might see some other trace of his passage. He might even decide to return. But nothing happened. There wasn't a sound except the prosaic growl of my stomach, reminding me that I hadn't eaten lunch and that it was now supper time. I went into the house on shaking legs and collapsed at the table. Conversation with a spy, interview with an insane fairy. Oh, yes. Phone Jason and tell him to be back on fairy watch. That was something I could do sitting down. After that conversation, I remembered to carry in the newspapers when I got my legs to working again. While I baked to Marie Callender's pot pie, I read the past 2 days' papers. Unfortunately, there was a lot of interest on the front page. There had been a gruesome murder in Shreveport, probably gang-related. The victim had been a young black man wearing gang colors, which was like a blinking arrow to the police, but he hadn't been shot. He'd been stabbed multiple times, and then his throat had been slashed. Yuck. Sounded more personal than a gang killing to me. Then the next night, the same thing had happened again, this time to a kid of 19 who wore different gang colors. He died the same awful way. I shook my head over the stupidity of young men dying over what I considered nothing, and moved on to a story that I found electrifying and very worrisome. The tension over the werewolf registration issue was rising. According to the newspapers, the wares were the big controversy. The stories hardly mentioned the other two natured, yet I knew at least one werefox, one werebat, two weretigers, a score of werepanthers, and a shapeshifter. Werewolves, the most numerous of the two-natured, were catching the brunt of the backlash, and they were sounding off about it, as they should have.
Why should I register? As if I were an illegal alien or a dead citizen.
Scott Wacker, an army general, was quoted as saying,
My family has been American for 6 generations. All of us Army people. My daughter's in Iraq. What more do you want?
The governor of one of the northwestern states said,
We need to know who's a werewolf and who's not. In the event of an accident, officers need to know to avoid blood contamination and to aid in identification.
I plunged my spoon into the crust to release some of the heat from the pot pie. I thought that over. Bullshit, I concluded.
That's bourgeois,
General Wacker responded in the next paragraph. So Wacker and I had something in common.
For one thing, we change back to human form when we're dead. Officers already glove up when they're handling bodies. Identification is not going to be any more of a problem than with the one-natured. Why should it be?
You go, Wacker. According to the newspaper, the debate raged from the people in the streets, including some who weren't simply people, to members of Congress, from military personnel to firefighters, from law experts to constitutional scholars. Instead of thinking globally or nationally, I tried to evaluate the crowd at Merlot's since the announcement. Had revenue fallen off? Yes, there'd been a slight decrease at first, right after the bar patrons had watched Sam change into a dog and Trey become a wolf, but then people had started drinking as much as they had formerly. So was this a created crisis, a nothing issue? Not as much as I would have liked, I decided, having read a few more articles. Some people really hated the idea that individuals they'd known all their lives had another side, a mysterious life, unbeknownst, isn't that a great word? It had been on my word of the day calendar the week before, to the general public. That was the impression I'd gotten before, and it seemed that still held true. No one was budging on that position. The wares got angrier, and the public got more frightened. At least a very vocal part of the public. There had been demonstrations and riots in Redding, California and Lansing, Michigan. I wondered if there were going to be riots here or in Shreveport. I found that hard to believe and painful to picture. I looked through the kitchen window at the gathering dusk, as if I expected to see a crowd of villagers with torches marching to Merlot's. It was a curiously empty evening. There wasn't much to clean up after I'd eaten. My laundry was up to date, and there was nothing on television I wanted to watch. I checked my email. No message from Judith Vardaman. There was a message from Alcide.
Sucky, we've set the pack meeting for Monday night at 8 at my house. We've been trying to find a shaman for the judging. I'll see you and Jason then.
It had been nearly a week since we'd found Basim's body in the woods, and this was the first I'd heard. The pack's day or two had stretched into 6, and that meant it had been a very long time since I'd heard from Eric. I called Jason again and left voicemail on his cell phone. I tried not to worry about the pack meeting, but every time I'd been with the whole pack, something violent had happened. I thought again about the dead man in the grave and the clearing. Who had put him there? Presumably the killer had wanted Basim's silence, but the body hadn't been planted on my land by mistake. I read for 30 minutes or so, and then it was full dark, and I felt Eric's presence, and then the lesser, though undeniable, company of the other two vampires. As soon as they woke, I felt tired. This made me so twitchy I broke my own resolution. I knew that Eric realized I was unhappy and worried. It was impossible for him not to know that. Maybe he thought by keeping me away he was protecting me. Maybe he didn't know that his maker and Alexei were both in my consciousness. I took a deep breath and called him. The phone rang, and I pressed it to my ear as though I were holding Eric himself. But I thought, and I wouldn't have believed this possible a week ago, what if he doesn't pick up? The phone rang, and I held my breath. After the second ring, Eric answered. The pack meeting has been set, I blurted.
Sookie, he said, can you come here?
On my drive to Shreveport, I wondered at least 4 times if I was doing the right thing. But I concluded that whether I was right or wrong in running to see Eric when he asked me to was simply a dead issue. We were both on the ends of the line stretched between us, a line spun from blood. It trumped how we felt about each other at any given moment. I knew he was tired and desperate. He knew I was angry, uneasy, hurt. I wondered, though, if I'd called him and said the same thing, would he have hopped into his car or into the sky and arrived on my doorstep. They were all at Fantasia, he'd said. I was shocked to see how few cars were parked in front of the only vampire bar in Shreveport. Fantasia was a huge tourist draw in a town that was boasting a tourist increase, and I'd expected it to be packed. There were almost as many cars parked in the employee parking at the back as there were at the main door. That had never happened before. Maxwell Lee, an African-American businessman who also happened to be a vampire, was on duty at the rear entrance, and that was a first, too. The rear door had never been specially guarded because the vampires were so sure they could take care of themselves. Yet here he was, wearing his usual three-piece suit, but doing a task he normally would have considered beneath him. He didn't look resentful. He looked worried. I said, "Where are they?" He jerked his head toward the main room of the bar. "I'm glad you're here," he said, and I knew Eric's maker's visit wasn't going well. So often having out-of-town visitors is awkward, huh? You take them to see local sights, you try to feed them and keep them entertained, but then you're really wishing they would leave. It wasn't hard to see that Eric was on his last nerve. He was sitting in a booth with Appius Livius Ocella and Alexei. Of course, Alexei looked too young to be in a bar, and that added to the absurdity of the moment. "Good evening," I said stiffly. "Eric, you wanted to see me?" Eric scooted over closer to the wall so I'd have plenty of room, and I sat by him. Appius Livius and Alexei both greeted me, Appius with a strained smile, and Alexei with more ease. When we were all together, I discovered that being close to them relaxed the tense thread inside me, the thread that bound us all together.
"I've missed you,"
Eric said so quietly that at first I thought I'd imagined it. I wouldn't refer to the fact that he'd been completely out of touch for days. He knew that. It took all my self-control to bite back a few choice words. "As I was trying to tell you over the phone, the pack meeting about Basim has been set for Monday night."
"Where and when?"
he said, and there was a note in his voice that let me know he was not a happy camper. Well, he could pitch his tent right alongside mine. "At Alcide's house, the one that used to be his dad's, at 8 o'clock.
"And Jason's going with you, without a doubt?"
"I haven't talked to him yet, but I left him a message."
"You've been angry with me."
"I've been worried about you." I couldn't tell him anything about how I'd felt that he didn't already know.
"Yes,"
Eric said. His voice was empty.
"Eric is an excellent host,"
the Tsarevich said, as if I expected a report. I scratched up a smile to offer the boy.
"That's good to hear, Alexei. What have you two been doing? I don't think you've ever been to Shreveport before."
"No,"
Appius Livius said in his curious accent.
"We hadn't been here to visit. It's a nice little city. My older son has been doing his best to keep us busy and out of trouble."
Okay, that had been a tad on the sarcastic side. I could tell from Eric's tension that he hadn't entirely succeeded in the keeping them out of trouble part of his agenda.
"The world market is fun. You can get stuff from all over the world there. And Shreveport was the capital of the Confederacy for a while."
Jeez Louise, I needed to do better than that.
"If you go to the municipal auditorium, you can see Elvis's dressing room," I said brightly.
I wondered if Bubba ever visited there to see his old stomping grounds.
"I had a very good teenager last night,"
Alexei said, matching my cheerful tone, as though he'd said he'd run a red light. I opened my mouth and nothing came out. If I said the wrong thing, I might be dead right then and there.
"Alexei,"
I said, sounding much calmer than I felt,
"you have to watch it. That's against the law here. Your maker and Eric could both suffer for it." "Then I was with my human family. I could do anything I wanted," Alexei said. I really couldn't read his voice at all. "I was so sick, they indulged me."
Eric twitched.
"I can sure understand that," I said. "Any family would be tempted to do that with a sick child. But since you're well now, and you've had a lot of years to mature, I know you understand that doing exactly what you want to do is not a good plan."
I thought of at least 20 other things I could have said, but I stopped right there. And that was a good thing. Appius Livius looked directly into my eyes and nodded almost imperceptibly.
I don't look grown up, Alexei said.
Again, too many options on what I could say. The boy, the old, old boy, definitely expected me to answer.
No, and it's an awful pity what happened to you and your family, but...
And Alexei reached over, took my hand, and showed me what had happened to him and his family. I saw the cellar, the royal family, the doctor, the maid, facing the men who had come to kill them, and I heard the guns fire, and the bullets found their marks. Or, in the case of the women, they didn't, since the royal women had sewn jewels into their clothes for the escape that never came about. The jewels saved their lives for all of a few seconds, until the soldiers killed each groaning and bleeding and screaming individual. His mother, his father, his sisters, his doctor, his mother's maid, the cook, his father's valet, and his dog. And after the shooting, the soldiers went around with bayonets. I thought I was going to throw up. I swayed where I sat, and Eric's cold arm went around me. Alexei had let go, and I was never gladder of anything in my life. I would not have touched the child again for anything.
You see, Alexei said triumphantly. You see, I should be free to go my own way.
No, I said, and I was proud that my voice was firm. No matter how we suffer, we have an obligation to others. We have to be unselfish enough to try to live in the right way, so others can get through their own lives without us fouling them up. Alexei looked rebellious.
That's what Master says, too, he muttered. More or less.
Master is right, I said, though the words tasted bad in my mouth. Master waved for the bartender to come over. Felicia slunk up to the table. She was tall and pretty and as gentle as a vampire can be. She had some fresh scars on her neck.
What can I get you all? She said. Sookie, can I bring you a beer or...
Some iced tea would be great, Felicia, I said.
And some true blood for all of you? She asked the vampires, or we do have a bottle of royalty?
Eric's eyes closed, and Felicia realized her blunder.
Okay, she said briskly. True blood for Eric, tea for Sookie.
Thank you, I said, smiling up at the bartender. Pam strode up to the table. She was trailing the gauzy black costume she wore at Fantasia, and she was as close to panic as I'd ever seen her.
Excuse me, she said, bowing in the direction of the guests. Eric, Catherine Boudreau is visiting Fantasia tonight. She's with Sally and a small party.
Eric looked as if he were going to explode.
Tonight, he said, and one word spoke volumes. With much regret, Okella, I must ask you and Alexei to go back to my office.
Appius Livius got up without asking for further explanation, and Alexei, to my surprise, followed him without any questions. If Eric had been in the habit of breathing, I would say that he exhaled with relief when his visitors had left his sight. He said a few things in an ancient tongue, but I didn't know which one. Then, a stout, attractive blonde in her 40s was standing by the table, another woman right behind her.
You must be Catherine Boudreau, I said pleasantly. I'm Sookie Stackhouse. I'm Eric's girlfriend.
Hi, honey. I'm Catherine, she said. This is my partner, Sally. We're here with some friends who are curious about my job. I try to visit all the vampire workplaces during the year, and we hadn't been to Fantasia in months. Since I'm based right here in Shreveport, I ought to make it in more often.
We're so glad you're here,
Eric said smoothly. He sounded like his normal self.
Sally, always good to see you. How's the tax business?
Sally, a slim brunette whose hair was just beginning to gray, laughed.
Taxes are booming, as always, she said.
You ought to know, Eric. You pay enough of them.
It's good to see our vampire citizens getting along with our human citizens,
Catherine said heartily, looking around the bar, which was so thinly populated it almost wasn't open. Her blonde eyebrows contracted slightly for a moment, but that was the only sign Ms. Boudreau gave that she noticed Eric's business was down. Pam said,
Your table is ready.
She swept her hand toward two tables that had been put together for the party, and the state BVA agent said,
Excuse me, Eric, I've got to go pay attention to my company.
After a shower of pleasantries and pleased to meet yous, We were finally by ourselves, if sitting in a booth in the middle of a bar can be counted as being by ourselves. Pam started over, but Eric checked her with a raised finger. He took my hand with one of his and rested his forehead on his other hand.
"Can you tell me what's up with you?" I said bluntly. "This is awful. It's very hard to have faith in us when I don't know what's happening."
"Okella has had some business to discuss with me," Eric said. "Some unwelcome business. And as you saw, my half-brother is ailing."
"Yes, he shared that with me," I said. It was still hard to believe what I'd seen and suffered with the child through his memory of the deaths of everyone he'd loved. The Tsarevich of Russia, sole survivor of a mass murder, could use some counseling. Maybe he and Dermot could be in the same therapy group.
"You don't go through something like that and come out Mr. Mental Health, but I've never experienced anything like that. I know it must have been hell for him, but I've got to say..."
"You don't want to go through it, too," Eric said. "You're not alone in that. It's clearest for us, Okella, me, you. But he can share that with other people, too. It's not as detailed for them, they tell me. No one wants that memory. We all carry plenty of our own bad memories. I'm afraid that he may not be able to survive as a vampire."
He paused, turning the bottle of True Blood around and around on the table.
"Apparently it's a nightly grind to get Alexei to do the simplest things, and not to do others. You heard his remark about the teenager? I don't want to go into the details. However, have you read the papers lately? The Shreveport papers?"
"You mean Alexei might be responsible for those two murders?"
I could only sit there staring at Eric.
"The stab wounds? The throats? But he's so small and young."
"He's insane," Eric said. "Okella finally told me that Alexei had had episodes like this before, not as severe. It has led him to consider, very reluctantly, giving Alexei the final death."
"You mean putting him to sleep?" I said, not sure I'd heard him right. "Like a dog?" Eric looked me straight in the eyes.
"Okella loves the boy, but he cannot be allowed to kill people or other vampires when these fits take him. Such incidents will get into the paper. What if he were caught? What if some Russian recognized him as a result of the notoriety? What would that do to our relationship with the Russian vampires? Most important, Okella cannot keep track of him every moment. 2 times, the boy has gotten out on his own, and 2 deaths resulted in my area. He'll subvert all we're trying to do here in the United States. Not that my maker cares about my position in this country," Eric added, a little bitterly.
I gave Eric a sort of heavy pat on the cheek. Not a slap, a heavy pat.
"Yeah, let's not forget the 2 dead men, I said, that Alexei murdered in a painful and horrible way. I mean, I realize that this is all about him and your maker and your personal cred, but let's spare a tip of the hat to those guys he killed."
Eric shrugged. He was worried, and he was at his wit's end, and he didn't care at all about the deaths of 2 humans. He was probably thankful that Alexei had picked victims who wouldn't attract much sympathy and whose deaths were easily explained. Gang members killed one another all the time, after all. I gave up on making my point, at least partly because I'd had a thought. If Alexei was capable of turning against his own kind, maybe we could steer him onto Victor. I shuddered. I was creeping myself out.